Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, if a diet of fast food is recognized as unhealthy, then wouldn't it make sense that a diet of high-quality food would be good for you? A nationally known registered dietitian explains the new food movement known as qualitarian and why it could lead to better health.
But first, the ability to determine the direction of our lives is an essential right that we hold dear. So it might seem odd that many of us don't necessarily exercise that right with regard to our own death, deciding on the types of treatments and measures we'd want to stay alive, or declining treatment to die with dignity and in comfort, is difficult, even when we're young and healthy. But making those decisions in advance is the only way we can ensure that our wishes are carried out.
There are many terms we hear about: living wills, medical directives, DNR orders. But which ones are most effective in communicating our desires to relatives and medical personnel? Joining us for a discussion on medical directives is a leading authority on this topic. Dr. Baron Lerner is an internist, ethicist, medical historian, and professor of medicine at the NYU School of Medicine. His most recent book is The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Lerner. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's very hard and uncomfortable, frankly, to think of one's own health declining to the point where we'll no longer be able to make decisions about our final days. But not having our wishes known in writing can lead to medical interventions and treatments that may prolong pain and suffering for the patient and their family with no ends in sight. But before we talk about specific advanced medical directives, will you discuss why they're so important and what role they play in treating patients who are critically ill?
Well, we see all the time in the hospital patients who come in critically ill. Decisions need to be made urgently about how aggressive the doctor should be. Sometimes it's obvious what to do or what not to do, but oftentimes it's much more ambiguous. And in the cases where this has been discussed in advance by a patient, hopefully with their family, hopefully with their doctor, it gives us guidance, because making decisions in the heat of the moment can be very, very difficult. You can imagine a patient gasping for breath, for example, a patient confused, and you're trying to have a coherent discussion about what to do. That's really not the ideal time to have that discussion.
So when is the ideal time?
Well, from my perspective, the ideal time is when the person is perfectly healthy and in your office, ideally, and you have a little bit of extra time to discuss future issues. So I would certainly be the first to say there's some medical appointments when I see patients and we're so busy dealing with current issues that there's not a lot of time. But I do try, either in an appointment or between appointments, to get patients to begin to think broadly about what sort of interventions they would or wouldn't want should they deteriorate at the end of life and not be able to make decisions.
Linda and I were talking about this earlier. When you're well, it's hard to think about two different things. As I mentioned earlier, one is people resist thinking about their own death and demise because it's painful and uncomfortable to think about. So that may be one reason people resist doing it. But also, I think it's very hard to know yourself, know what you'll be dealing with. How would I know in midlife what I would want done? Now, you are reaching out to your own patients, and I don't know how common that experience is. But how should one go about doing the soul searching that would be necessary to come to the right conclusion for them when they're projecting into the future?
Yeah, these are very hard issues, because I'd be the first to say you never can predict exactly what's going to happen, right? Different people get sick from different things. There's certain diseases where there seems to be a relatively straightforward progression of symptoms. I'm thinking of something like Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's, where there's a period of health and then an expected deterioration. But even in those cases, you don't know exactly what is apt to occur at the end. We don't expect patients, and I don't expect my patients, to be able to give firm answers. But there are broad principles, I think, that people can talk about. So I often ask patients if they've had other loved ones who've gotten very sick and what that experience has been like for them. I ask them sort of philosophical questions. Are they the sort of person who likes to leave no stone unturned? Or are they someone, if their life was deteriorating, might be more passive and say, I've lived a good life? So I try to answer more broad questions, at least initially, to get a sense of the patient's philosophy. And then, most importantly, get them to tell that to their loved ones, hopefully as a formal healthcare proxy, someone who will be in charge of making these decisions when that person deteriorates.
You do this for your patients, but how common is this in the medical community?
I think it's variable. I don't always do a perfect job either, and certainly some of my patients push back. I mean, what you guys were saying about people not wanting to talk about this is very common, especially I think in the United States we sort of have a death-defying culture, so a lot of people don't want to talk about it even when I bring it up. But I try to broach the subject again with most people, and I try to take it at the pace that they want. And again, sometimes it's good to have sort of a broad discussion of the principles early on. I think that sort of warms people up to talk about the subject. There's certainly other doctors who probably do a better job of this than I do, and then there's others who are probably less apt to raise the issue. But most patients, in my experience, are glad when you bring the subject up.
All right, then, bringing the subject up. What are the most common forms, documents, medical directives that are currently being used?
And this varies from state to state, so you really need to do some research yourself depending on where you live. These are not really national documents. They tend to be state documents, and even within specific hospitals, there's specific documents. But the three main ones are a DNR form, so do not resuscitate, and that is a very specific question. If my heart stops, the doctors try to start it up again or not? The second one is called the living will, in which a patient writes down directions about what they do or don't want in a particular situation. So, for example, if I have no chance of meaningful recovery, please don't do X, Y, and Z. And then third, what I mentioned before, the healthcare proxy form, which I think most ethicists these days would say is the most effective, in which you designate a person and a backup person to be your decision maker when you lose capacity to make decisions themselves. And ideally, you've had one or more comprehensive discussions with that person in advance to communicate your philosophy to them.
So let's just go back to the very first one you talked about, the do not resuscitate, which you explained means do not restart my heart. Now, if you haven't had a long illness and you come into the emergency room with something that really isn't life-threatening, but you've filled out a DNR. I mean, that's an example of filling it out before you know what you're dealing with. You would want them to restart your heart if what you had wasn't life-threatening, wouldn't you?
Yes. So most DNR forms are filled out by people with terminal diseases or who are very, very ill, where the potential of the heart stopping is a real one and a decision needs to be made. The other two forms tend to be the ones that people use more in advance because they communicate more broader issues. So you're exactly right. DNR forms usually are used best for people, for example, with terminal cancer, with end-stage congestive heart failure, that sort of thing. The fact that you have a DNR form should not preclude your using healthcare proxy form as well. Usually they go well in conjunction.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
And our guest today is Dr. Baron Lerner, a bioethicist, medical historian, author, and internist at the New York University School of Medicine. His most recent book is The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. And we're talking today about medical directives. We just talked about a DNR. The second one that you mentioned was a living will. What's included? What details are included in a living will? And what should we be thinking about as we prepare to make these decisions and fill out a form like that?
Well, living will is a tricky form because, as we talked about before, you don't know what's going to happen usually as you deteriorate. So, for example, someone who has end-stage cancer might develop a pneumonia, but it's hard to write down in a form, if I get pneumonia, do X, Y, and Z. So one of the challenges with living wills is to find language that informs the doctors about what you want to do, but isn't too specific. But the best living wills, I think, communicate a philosophy. I think people will say something about their quality of life. They will talk about reversibility or irreversibility of their disease, ability to communicate with others. And in those cases, most people who fill out the form will say at some point, if I have no chance of meaningful recovery, if I have a neurological condition that isn't going to get better, please do not do heroic treatment, such as putting me on a ventilator, trying to restart my heart, putting me in an ICU. So that's the language that you find in most living wills, that sort of thing.
So you really can deduce, as you said, the philosophy and attitude the patient has. And then when it comes to making decisions on the details, you can have a pretty good idea of what their wishes really are.
Yes, but one of the tricks with living wills and one of the downsides and why some people prefer healthcare proxies is the devil's in the details. So you can have these broad philosophical statements, but when you look at each individual case, it might not fill exactly the criteria that the person wrote down in the living will, which is why ideally you've also got a loved one who is going to help the doctors make the actual decision. I'll give you an example. Some people say, if I have no chance of meaningful neurological recovery, don't do anything aggressive. Well, sometimes you'll see a patient have a bleed into their head, and the neurologist might say, well, there's a 5% chance of recovery. So then you're stuck because, strictly speaking, there is a chance of recovery, but it's a very small chance. So then if you just have that living will, you might not know what to do in that particular situation. But if you've got a family member who has spoken to the patient, that person might say, look, with these odds, the person either would have wanted us to be aggressive or wouldn't have wanted us to be aggressive.
Yes, so often it's the gray area and it's not straightforward. But let's just talk about the third important document that you talked about originally, which is the healthcare proxy. Just out of curiosity, for people that are in middle age and older that are married, do they usually make their spouse the healthcare proxy? What if something happened and neither of them were in good shape to make medical decisions, for instance, a car accident? What do you recommend? What do you counsel people to do? Who should be your healthcare proxy?
Well, in most cases, I think people who are married and not, for example, separated will choose their spouse. It's a logical person to choose. It's your life partner. It's someone you've spent time with. It's someone you should have had these discussions with anyway. Most healthcare proxy forms have a backup proxy for that exact reason. So there's a second person in case the first person can't be reached. A lot of people, older people, will choose a child. Some people will choose a sibling, a good friend. There's always a possibility these forms aren't going to work. There's some kind of a crisis. You can't reach somebody, but there's only so much you can do on paper. But when the forms are filled out properly and there's been a careful selection of the person and some kind of discussion with that person, they usually work pretty well.
What about filling out those forms? Can anybody do it? Is there a legal process that's involved? Do you have to include an attorney? And who keeps these forms?
In most states, you don't have to get it notarized or have a lawyer involved. So, I know New York State best, and there's a form. It's a legal document. You have to have two witnesses to the form. So the person designates one proxy. They designate a backup. They put all the demographic information in, and there's two witnesses. And if that is filled out properly, it is a legally binding form. I tell my patients to spread the document far and wide because, as we know, these crises always seem to occur in the middle of the night. And so I tell the patient to keep a copy. I tell them to give copies to the people they've designated. I tell them to give copies to their doctor. I think these days, more and more in the era of electronic medical records, this information can also go onto the computer. So doctor in the middle of the night going onto the patient's record, if the patient has come to their usual hospital, can see some language that might even be able to help them in the emergency room. And that's great because that's a huge advance over the old days.
Dr. Baron Lerner is an ethicist, medical historian, writer, internist, and professor of medicine at the New York University School of Medicine. His most recent book, The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Thank you so much for joining us on Take Care.
Thank you.